Thank you for joining us. I'm Julie Vecchio, and this is the Fisheries Podcast, a weekly podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fishery science. If you haven't already, follow the podcast on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram at Fisheries Pod, or support the podcast on Patreon or Teespring if you feel inclined. Our Teespring store has just added face masks and kids' t-shirts, so head on over to check it out. We've got a design for everyone. This week, my guest is Eric Wade. Eric is a PhD candidate studying human dimensions of fisheries management at Oregon State University under the advice of Dr. Kelly Biedenwig. He's from the country of Belize and is talking to us from there now. Prior to starting his doctoral degree, he received a BS in marine biology at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington, an MS in fisheries science at Oregon State University. He's also worked in Belize's fisheries department. One of his main long-term goals is promoting and securing the sustainable development of coastal and marine resources of the Caribbean. His work integrates theories from social psychology, sociology, and behavioral economics to understand small-scale fisheries. He's primarily intrigued by questions around property rights and institutions, sustainable livelihoods, adaptation to change, conservation and development, risk and uncertainty in environmental decision-making, and conservation psychology. Welcome to the podcast, Eric. I'm really eager to learn more about your path and your work on Belizean fisheries.
Hi, Julie. Thank you so much. I'm excited to be here. Talking about Belize is my favorite topic. Talking about fisheries is my favorite topic. So yeah, I'm really excited. Thank you so much for having me.
So I went to Belize one time, over 20 years ago, and I have definitely never forgotten it. It's so amazing.
We need to have you back then.
I love it.
Diving is great, the food is great, the people are great. Yeah.
Yeah, the people were incredible. So amazing, so wonderfully kind and just knowledgeable about, you know, the ocean and the fish and everything like that, and amazing. I would love to come back someday.
Yeah, I think in all my presentations that I have, I put a plug in for everyone to visit Belize. I think I'm unofficial ambassador for travel to Belize at this point.
I won't tell it now. I do have one hilarious story that I totally always remember. Maybe I should just tell it now. So when I was there in college, the only time that I went was during a college class. You know, we went to a research station or whatever. And I'm originally from Michigan. So like nothing marine or coastal or, you know, tropical or anything like that. And knew zero, nothing. Mm-hmm. And I learned so much. But one of the most hilarious memories that totally sticks with me is me and a couple other people went into, you know, just like a little corner shop or whatever to buy some snacks and stuff. And I bought a beer and the woman behind the counter was like, "Oh, you want me to open that for you?" And I was like, "Okay." And the person that was with me was like, "Wait, you're allowed to walk down the street with an open beer?" And she's like, "This is a free country."
Yes. See,
and I was like, touche.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's, yeah, the spirit of Belize, I feel like. And we should probably get that on a t-shirt sometime.
This is a free country. What got you interested in the ocean in the first place? Were you a kid who was always in or on the water?
So that's a great question. And I think the ocean from where I live, so I live right now in a very small rural village in maybe this north central part of Belize, close to Orange Walk, if you're familiar with Belize geography. So the ocean is about 45 minutes from where I actually live. But around my village, there's a lagoon. And so when I was a kid, my cousins and I used to go and play swim in the lagoon. And so we used to have a good time playing in the lagoon and just having a good time. And so that was my initial, like, interest in water bodies, for lack of a better word. Mm-hmm. And then from then I went to high school and I had this big idea that I was going to be a doctor, a cardiologist. Then I figured out I didn't like blood. And then I was like, oh, should probably change that. and so I got interested somehow in marine biology. I think I watched a show at some point, and I was like, oh, I think I can do this. And so that was my introduction to the ocean. And then throughout college and throughout my education and experience, my love for the ocean grew, and the vastness of it, and the limitless opportunities to explore, and there's always something new in the ocean, has just continued to pique my interest. And that's how I got interested in the ocean. It wasn't a direct interest, like this is a direct path that I have had from a kid. Wanted to be a cardiologist. My mom probably still wants me to be a doctor. But yeah, so that was my foray into the oceans and finding my love of the ocean.
I think it's a good choice. If you don't like human blood, there's definitely not very much human blood out there in the ocean. If you're in fisheries, there might be some more fish blood going on, but
I can do that. So I figured I learned that I could do the fish blood. We had some dissections in high school of fish. I was like, oh, I could do fish blood. Human blood was not as easy as the fish blood.
No, I'm totally with you there. Yeah, I don't know. Human blood does totally freak me out, but I can take apart a fish, no problem.
Oh yes. Okay.
So what got you specifically interested in the topic of fisheries?
Right. So after I did, like you mentioned, I did my undergrad. I finished my undergrad in North Carolina after I started here in Belize, at the University of Belize. And after I came back from North Carolina, I started working for the fisheries department here in Belize. And I started out just doing data management, doing some of their statistics for them on coral reefs. And then I shifted to working more or capture fisheries, which deals with spiny lobster, queen conch. And then I slowly transitioned again to working with communities and trying to understand how communities were responding to new fisheries policies, what were their interactions with the fisheries industry, and how they were adapting to change pretty much in the fisheries industry. So from that journey through fisheries, starting from the data to looking at the capture fisheries to then working with communities, all of that together really piqued my interest. So I was at the fisheries department for maybe 2 years. And I realized that after working with communities, that I really loved working with communities. And that was what I wanted to continue doing. And so I tried to figure out a way that I could continue still doing fisheries work, but working with communities. Because I figured there's a lot we don't know about these communities, and a lot, and people are so complex. And so I really...
understatement, huh?
Right? Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and fishers, I think if we've all talked to fishers and heard their stories, and they are some of the best storytellers, and I really wanted to be able to tell their stories in my work. And so I really tried to figure out a way how I could mesh fisheries with telling the stories of fisher folks. And so that's how I got interested in where I am now. But it, again, similar to my interest in ocean story, a long route to get there.
I'm impressed that Belize Fisheries has, programs that are specifically targeting the communities and talking to them and, finding out about their needs and that sort of thing. I mean, obviously it's necessary, but I think a lot of times it's a step that's skipped within the fisheries management community.
Right. Yeah, I totally agree. And I think that's what I liked working. That's why I liked working with them, was this emphasis on fishers and trying to understand their needs, trying to understand their interactions with the system, with the fisheries system, and all the dynamics of that system, from the ecological, the social, institutional, economic. Realizing that was something that I wanted to continue. And I knew it wasn't done as much in other places. And there were so many other dynamics happening that almost dictates how someone behaves or how a fisher behaves. And that's what I wanted to explore. And Belize had the capacity to only go so far. I think working for the government or any government, you realize that their capacity is very limited in terms of human resource, financial resources. And so I wanted to go further. And so I continued working with Belize even for my master's to try and help them out to so we can better understand the people.
Yeah, that's really cool. So you specifically went to Oregon State so that you could continue this work with the Fishers of Belize?
Yes. So when I pitched my research proposal to my advisor, Kelly, she was like, do you have a project in mind? I was like, yes, I have a project in mind. I know what I want to do. Here's what I want to do. So I was very specific on I wanted to work with Belizean Fishers for my master's. So I was very set on that because I knew I wanted to contribute back to Belize at some point. Belize is the starting point of my interest in fisheries, of my interest in the oceans. And so it was really important for me to be able to work with the people that helped me get started.
And so your PhD work is a continuation of what you did in your master's as well?
So my PhD, it's to some extent it is, but now I'm in Jamaica. So now I am working out with Jamaican fisheries and Jamaican fishers, an extension of the work in Belize, but not directly. I'm more in Jamaica, more looking at decision-making strategies, so how fishers make decisions within the uncertainty of the fisheries industry. Mm-hmm. And so we're using some of that groundwork that we found, the theoretical groundwork that we found in Belize and that we explored in Belize to help us understand the dynamics in Jamaica. So I'm unfortunately not continuing to work in Belize, but I miss working with the Belizean fishers greatly. I think a fun story is one of the fishers in the southern part of Belize in Dangriga, she was asking me, we keep in touch quite a bit, and she was one of the fishers that we really bonded together. And so she was like, Eric, when are you coming back to Dangriga? We're waiting to hear more about your research. I was like, oh no, I'm not in Belize anymore, I'm in Jamaica. She was like, what? Why are you there? It's like, there is nothing there for you. We are here. You need to come back. You need to come back here. Yeah, I love the work that I'm doing in Jamaica, but the draw from Belize is still there. And the fact that the fishers still remember me, I think it's amazing. And I keep going back to that, that they still remember me and we still keep in touch. So she still wants me to come and talk about research and chit chat.
And that's so special. It's so nice to be able to just have good relationships, I think, especially mm-hmm. with fishers and especially like within, you know, there's such a dynamic between the managers and the researchers and the fishers and that if you can really sit down and really kind of explain what you're trying to do and, mm-hmm. you know, act in good faith, then a lot of times relationships can be better.
Oh, yes. I completely agree. And I think that is sometimes missing in some research. I think some researchers often just come to countries for 2 weeks and then go back without really having that relationship with people on the ground. And for me, having that relationship is pretty important. I like to be able to interact with the communities mm-hmm. for a while before we start doing that research, because we don't want it to be extractive. And just simply just getting their knowledge and then not coming back or interacting with them.
I've done most of my work, you know, within the States, but I feel like even if it is a community that's physically local to you, if you mm-hmm. aren't having those deeper, longer interactions, then there's really that breeding ground for mistrust.
I completely agree. I think mistrust and relations and this lack of relationship in natural resources for is really important, and I think it's something that maybe some researchers are not taught it, but I think it's something that is really because we for lack of a better word need the data from mm-hmm. our stakeholders and these and fishers. I think it's important for us to build these relationships and build trust before we start getting data. And that's one of my goals, is to be able to ensure that research assistants really build that relationship, build that trust, regardless of communities that you're in. Like you said, I think it's important for us to have that trust and that relationship, because it's like when you get a telemarketing call, I don't have a relationship with you. I'm not going to have a conversation and So I think it's similar to a fisher. They have that, I think they have that same guard up. I don't know you. I don't trust you. What are you going to do with this information?
Yeah, I love that. I love, yeah, the telemarketer. Yeah, you totally. Yeah, I'm like a telemarketer just like coming up to you. Like, you just tell me some stuff.
Yeah.
No. Do you feel like you've had the time to be able to do that in Jamaica?
So I think I was in Jamaica for a couple of months in 2019. So I've started that process.
Okay.
And I was supposed to be in Jamaica now.
Sure.
So in, I think, July or September last year, I was supposed to go down in Jamaica to carry out the bulk of my field work. But unfortunately, I'm not. Sadly, I can't do that right now. But regardless of me not being there, I think I've still continued making contact with my collaborators in Jamaica, with the people that I met in 2019. And I think that's important. Even though I can't be there physically, we still have phone calls, we still have Zoom talks, just so that I can keep them updated on how the project is going. And physical distance is a barrier at this point, but there's so much we can still do mm-hmm. over the internet. And so I can try to continue building that because I don't want that to break down.
Well, it seems like your connectivity is pretty good there where you are. And so, yeah, as long as you've got some good, relatively good internet on both sides, you can, it's amazing how much you can get done. We're all amazed constantly
right.
for the last year, how much we can get done and how many people we can talk to from all over.
Right. Yeah. The possibilities have been quite remarkable with Zoom and listening to webinars. Because there's some things that we would not have had the opportunity to like sit in on, to have conversations with folks if it wasn't for Zoom. So there's some bright side.
I mean, I'm not saying it's great, but I think, yeah, I think a lot of us have become more resourceful with the resources mm-hmm. that we have available. And you mentioned that you're in Belize right now. Are you just there sort of in between semesters? Are you going back to Oregon?
I am going back to Oregon eventually. I've been here for several weeks now. Mm. So there was really no reason for me to be in Oregon.
Mm. All the classes are online.
I'm not taking any more classes.
So I
finished my classes a couple of years ago. So
gotcha.
At this point, it's just doing research and teaching. Mm-hmm. And because I teach online, I can teach from wherever in the world. And so now, because of that, I was like, I can just stay in Belize for a couple months without rushing back to go to the U.S. at this point. I'm going to let the U.S. calm down for a bit.
That seems like a really good option right now.
Yeah, I'm really happy I have the option. I was like, let's just have the U.S. calm down, get their act together, and I will re-enter when things are calm.
I hope so.
I'm really enjoying being in my small little village right now. So it's really nice. It's very quiet. The only thing that I hear are birds and my parents' dogs. And so it's been really nice. And surprisingly, writing has been really good
here. Oh, good.
So I may have to come back to write my entire dissertation.
Since we've sort of touched on, you know, COVID and craziness and whatever, how are things going within Belize with the whole COVID situation?
Yeah, so I think similar to a lot of places, it's been up and down. We went from, it started out very slow here. So there were 5 or 6 cases and Belize completely shut down its borders.
Mm.
And so no one could get in. There was no flights coming in. Then for a couple of weeks, I think maybe a week or two, we had no cases at all. Then for some, I don't know what happened, but the cases just like spiked back up very rapidly, very steep curve.
They let tourists in?
So the airports were still closed. So private planes, unfortunately, were still landing. And we have, our borders are also quite porous, so people mm-hmm. can go back and forth between Mexico and Guatemala.
Yeah.
And so that did not lend itself very well to containing a global pandemic. Who would have thought? Yeah. And so the cases just kept rising. And we had, I think at one point we had over 2,000 cases, which for Belize has about 360,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
And so for us to have 2,000 cases is really a big deal.
Yeah.
And so it was going very bad for a while, and deaths started to increase. But we're starting to get better. The cases are still pretty high, but anything over zero for Belize, I think I consider being bad. Our hospitals are very small capacity, so we don't have the infrastructure to be able to deal with hundreds of people getting sick at the same time and needing to be hospitalized. So I think that has been a real eye-opener for us here.
Mm-hmm.
We're not as bad as Mexico. We still require a COVID test to enter, so there's still some restrictions to get to be able to try to safeguard how you enter. But I think the story that you told of walking on the street with the beer, Belizeans love to get together. We will have a celebration for the fact that it is Sunday. And so we love being social. And so having a pandemic that limits your social interactions is not something that goes down well with us. So it's been very interesting to see how we have changed our dynamics here, which happens everywhere. But when it's your own country, it's really funny to see. I don't know if it's funny, but it's
It's definitely, As a sociologist, I'm sure that you can observe it quite well.
It's predictable. It's predictable that trying to limit people's movement when we are.
So I think we've touched on this a little bit, but about your dissertation and just how highly interdisciplinary it is. With your dissertation, you said you're working primarily in Jamaica and looking at some of the decisions that fishers are making. Can you describe a little bit about the overall aims of your dissertation?
So broadly, I'm looking at decision-making strategies. So what that means for me is I'm trying to understand how it is that fishers make decisions when they go to sea. That can include ideas from the gear that they use, the species that they'll target, the location, how much money they'll spend on equipment. So all of those like pre-going fishing activities. And so I try to understand how they make those decisions, what are the dynamics. And so my work is also highly multi-scalar. So I look at how individuals make that decision, so individual fishers make a decision. And then I try to understand how groups make decisions. So what are the dynamics in group decision-making? Who's the boss? Who has the most power, the most influence in that group? So that's the idea that I'm trying to explore for my dissertation. It's trying to understand how people make decisions, how people negotiate in decisions, and what are some of the dynamics that influence those decisions, and whether or not there's some feedback, an interaction between individual decisions and group decisions and what that looks like. And so for this, I play a game with my fishers, for lack of a better word, where we try to mimic the social system as much as possible, the social and ecological system as much as possible, to try and understand how they hypothetically will make decisions.
Okay. So you basically set up a fisheries game and say, if this were true, then what are the decisions you're going to make?
Yes. Yeah. So we try to set up a game, and then I keep saying we, and it's just me when doing. So we set up this hypothetical game, and we change some of the probabilities across some of the scenarios and see how they would react and how their decisions would change with the probabilities that we change, with the different dynamics that we changed, and trying to see how they would make decisions. But we found that fishers really enjoy that. It's very different than just a survey, which surveys are great. I also have a survey in my dissertation, so no offense to the questionnaire people. But yeah, so I think, yeah, so it really helps with the engagement, and they seem to really like doing it, which is always a plus.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I've found that, I've worked in a camp settings and in the classroom, and I always feel like the more that you can really engage your participants, the more they're going to think about it and really, and sometimes actually enjoy what you're doing.
Right. Yes. And we definitely want them to enjoy and be a part of it. Because we don't want to, my work takes about 30 to 45 minutes. And so that is very long. And so I want to have them be engaged as much as possible the entire time. Mm-hmm. And so for that, I realized that I could not just ask them a questionnaire for 30 to 45. I don't want to do that, and I'm sure they don't want to do that.
No.
So I'm trying to be as considerate as possible and making sure it's enjoyable for all of us.
Do you think, I don't think this is necessarily a bad thing, but do you think that by playing the game that actually makes them think more about what's behind their decision-making and maybe make different decisions or, you know, change their mm-hmm. patterns in the future?
Right. So I think a lot of times, as humans, we don't, decision-makings are so intuitive. Mm-hmm. And it's become almost a tradition in how we make decisions and how we approach problems. And I think it's the same for them. So they've been fishing, some of them, for 25, 30 years. So they have a really set way of how they're approaching fishing, how they navigate that system. And then when you have them do these activities, it really, for me, I tried to probe and I was like, why did you make these decisions? Or why did you choose this? And why did you choose that? And for them, it would be because that's the way I've always been doing it. And I was like, so who influenced you? And so then we try to get majority of the time, it comes from these traditional way of doing things. Their father taught them, their grandfather taught them. Mm-hmm. And so we get these very rich stories about the motivations behind their decisions. Does it make them change or think more about their decisions? Yes. Do they modify it? Probably not. I feel like it's already so ingrained and they're so used to it that I think it just allows them to tell their stories. And that's the real point here that I'm trying to get is for them to tell their stories about how they're navigating this mm-hmm. ever-changing fisheries industry. Hopefully I'm not changing their decisions. I don't think my RB would like that.
I guess that's true. But I mean, I just feel like often, you know, when we kind of think more about where these decisions came from and mm-hmm. that maybe just by thinking about them that anyone has, you know, the reaction of, oh, maybe I could think more about, you know, the broader right. context or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. And I think that's very true. And I think that's, I think once you've triggered that in humans, you start thinking about that, that like the black box, I like to call it, of how we're making our decisions. And they start thinking about those dynamics that really you don't often think about when you're making decisions. You're really just going. And I think going back, I'm going to jump back really quick. Going back to one of the aims of my dissertation is that a lot of the times in fisheries, we talk about, we assume that fishers are only motivated by maximizing their profit and by economic and by trying to get as much money out of fishing as possible. When really there's so many more factors that are involved in how they're navigating that system that motivates them to go fishing. All of these non-monetary aspects of fishing that I think really doesn't get covered as much in fishers' motivation. And so for me, I also try to illuminate that a bit to try and show folks that we fishers are motivated by so much more. And when we really pull back the curtain and get into this black box, we can see those motivations that it's more than just money. While money is important for them to secure their livelihoods, there's a tradition there, there's a culture there. This is the fabric of who they are. When we start getting into those motivations behind their decisions and them thinking through their decisions, the common answer is, this is just what I do. And I was like, oh, okay, can you go more?
I think you're absolutely spot on. You know, whenever we think about fisheries management, right, we think, okay, the fishers are trying to get as much as they can, and our job as managers or biologists or whatever is mm-hmm. to, you know, counter that with maintaining the population so that more can get collected later, maximizing, your catch or your profit isn't necessarily the motivation all the time. Maybe there are other motivations within the fishing community that you have to consider if you're going to most appropriately manage the fishery.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And that's the goal that I'm trying to show for my dissertation, is that for us to really make holistic policies to manage fisheries, we need to consider the suite of factors that are driving how people make decisions. And that includes economic as well as non-economic factors. So we need to be able to understand all of these before we really try to design policies and regulations that sometimes are not really considering that dynamics and those trade-offs that fishers are making.
Bringing their voices to the table in whichever way that we're going to do it, if it's through, you know, sociological research or, you know, actually having them at the decision-making table is just so important. And I think we're finally just starting to get there in a lot of fisheries management decision-making.
Yes, exactly. Yes. And I think we're finally, hopefully getting to that point. UN Ocean Decade that we're currently in and the upcoming Year of Artisanal Fisheries in 2022, I think those are some ideas where I've started to see that they're starting to underscore the need for us to bring fishers at the table and have them be a part of how we navigate the system and set rules for the system, because at the end of the day, they're the ones that whose livelihoods depend on is their food security, their job security, their traditions and their culture. So why are they not at the table if they're inherently connected to the oceans?
So I was looking through some of your publications. It looks like you have at least 3 out there in the world already. Congratulations on that.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
Can you tell me a little bit more about your technique of cognitive mapping?
Yes. So cognitive mapping is something that Kelly introduced me to. And so what cognitive mapping does is that we're trying to externalize your mental models. And so mental models are really our view of the world around us. It helps us in navigating the world. It guides our decision-making and our behaviors. And so cognitive mapping externalizes that. And so what cognitive mapping does is it gives us the content as well as the structure of your mental models. And so content is pretty much just what's in your mental model. For example, when I think of fisheries, I think of the people, I think of the fish stocks, I think of coral reefs, I think of mangroves. So that's the content of my mental model. And then the structure is how I organize those content. Do I think people and fisheries go together, or do I think mangroves and fisheries go together, coral reefs and fisheries go together? And so that's what we try to get at in cognitive mapping, is that we try to understand what's in their thought process and their operationalization of a system. And then we try to externalize that and try to understand that. And so cognitive mapping is really powerful because it quantifies this, how people are viewing the system. It quantifies oftentimes what can be not very clear connections in how people are viewing a system. So we don't get that. Again, I'm going to preface this by saying I'm not against questionnaires, but this is my go-to comparison. So questionnaires just give us the content of how someone's viewing a system. It tells us what their attitudes are, what their values are. But cognitive mapping, why it's so powerful is that we get a structure. It's like a mind map or a guide to how someone is navigating a system and how they're viewing a system. And I think that's really powerful in fisheries, in biodiversity, because we need, first, again, going back to policymaking, for us to truly design holistic policies, we need to understand how people are viewing a system, how they're organizing that system in their minds. And that's what cognitive mapping does. Aside from all the theoretical and applied stuff, cognitive mapping is also really fun to do. Again, going back to keeping my fishers engaged, we do it with these concept cards. For example, I would ask them, can you describe what this new fisheries policy means? So we give them the cards. They would select the cards that best describes that fisheries policy. And then I would ask them, can you organize these cards based on how you think they go together? And so they would organize the cards and put them together. And then that is their cognitive map. And so it's really cool to see them externalize that and didn't even realize that that is how they thought about stuff. So, mm-hmm. Wow, I didn't realize that I would put these together. And I was like, why did you put these two items together? Why did you put these three cards together? It's like, oh, I didn't even realize I did that. So we can get these really rich stories of how they organize, what's important to them. I really love it. I really love cognitive mapping. You get both quantitative data and you also get some rich qualitative data as well.
Yeah, I was just thinking that sounded really hard to analyze.
Yes. Yeah, the quantitative, not so much. The quantitative, I prefer quantitative data. And the qualitative data, it's fun to listen to their stories. It adds to quantitative data can only tell us so much. And so that qualitative really adds to the dynamics and tries to help us explain some of the ideas that are happening behind those numbers.
So just again, from kind of just looking over some of your papers and stuff, it seemed like a lot of what you're finding isn't necessarily good news for fishers or the environment. Do you think that there's some high points or some reasons for hope?
Yes, I think there are definitely some reasons for hope. And I think the reasons for hope is that I think we've sometimes underestimated how much fishers are sustainable managers of the resources. And I think that needs to be underscored quite a bit more, is that fishers are not just they're not just being extracted. They're not just trying to take as much and destroy the habitat. They really care for these systems. They really care for the coral reef systems. They really care for the fish stocks. And that's what some of the ideas that arise from my studies are showing, is that they're really sustainable managers of the system. And if we can tap into that, if we can highlight that more, I think we can have the potential for some really powerful insights moving forward in ocean management and in ocean protection. But I think the narrative a lot of the times is that they're only trying to be extractive. And my work has really tried to highlight that this is it's more than that for them. They're not just these extractive, but they're really sustainable managers. They were the first managers of these systems. And so we need to be able to tap into their knowledge and learn from them if we're to really truly manage our ocean resources.
I think we're finally starting to learn that mm-hmm. you know, people really want there to be, you know, a future in fish and fisheries. So earlier on, you said that Belizeans are really pretty interested in getting together and hanging out and having beers and whatever else. and if that was a possibility right now, and you were, you know, hanging out with some friends over a few beers, mm-hmm. and you were able to start a story with, no shit, there I was. What do you think that story would be about?
I'm going to give a recent story in Jamaica, because I think this one is fresh, is more recent in my mind. So I was in Jamaica in 2019 doing some relationship building, which is just me hanging out on the fishing beaches, talking to fishers. And so I was introduced to this group of fishers initially. And so we were just talking, and they were playing dominoes. And one of the fishers was like, oh, do you want to play dominoes? I was like, yeah, sure. I have no idea how to play dominoes. Yeah, so I was like, sure, I'll play along. I think the last time I played dominoes, I was like 10 or 12. I was like, sure. So we started playing, and we were just there chatting, and it was time for me to leave. And for some reason, these guys came up to me trying to figure out why I was there. And one of the older guys that I was playing dominoes with really like ran over there and I was like, said some expletives that we won't say today. and I was like, back off of him. And he was saying it in Patois, which is the local language of Jamaica. So it was much more expressive. Mm-hmm. And he was like, don't do anything. And so he like took me to the bus stop where I was waiting for the bus. And while I was waiting for the bus, one of the fisher women was like, oh, you look hungry, come inside. I have some food to eat. I was like, oh, okay. And so, yeah, so we went inside, continued to have more conversations over fried fish and rice and beans. And we just continued chatting. And then after we finished chatting, she was like, okay, let's go to the bus stop now. And so we went to the bus stop and she put me on the bus. And I was like, oh, this is a story that I will always remember. Yeah, it was meaningful for me because it showed that we were starting to build that relationship, and also that we should not mess with fishers. they are not to be messed with, and they will protect you at all costs. And so that was very nice for me, because even though I was just there, that was my first interaction with them, they were not gonna let anything happen to me.
Like, I was actually just sitting here listening to the story and being like, would I love this or hate this? I don't really know, because I'm kind of an introvert, but then I just love like talking to fishers and like water people and like learning what they know. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I don't know if I could do it or not. Like, it might be really cool, but it might be really like terrifying.
Right. I think it's a mixture of both for sure. I think once I leave from interacting with fishers, it takes me hours to like get back and to like recharge and then go again. So I can only do so many interactions in a day before I need to recharge, which is very, yeah, for someone that works with people for a living, you think that I would just be on the go with interacting. But yeah, I can appreciate that. Yeah, you definitely need some time to recharge after giving a lot of your mental and emotional like energy and just staying in that conversation.
I mean, that's so cool that, you know, just after one game of dominoes, they were, you know, ready to just adopt you. It seemed like you're kind of finishing up on the PhD. And what do you think you want to do after you finish?
So my goal, I would love to continue working in the Caribbean or in Central America and the Caribbean, working on the ground with fishers. So that could either be in an academic position, it could be in development work. So at this point, I'm pretty open. I'm trying to spread my wings as wide as possible to see what I catch.
It seems like there might be some nonprofits doing that sort of thing.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And so trying to spread my wings as much as possible to see what's out there. But at the end of the day, my long-term goal has continued to remain that I want to continue to promote and work towards sustainable development of the Caribbean's fisheries, because I don't think we talk about it as much. And so that's my long-term goal. So finding the fit that allows me to do that is where I'm headed.
Yeah.
So hopefully I can find someone that lets me do that, or some institute that lets me do that. So yeah.
It doesn't seem that far-fetched. I think it's feasible.
Yes, exactly. Hopefully the market cooperates. The job market has brutal.
There is that. But don't underplay having connections and knowing people. And
yeah, exactly. Yeah, I completely agree. And that's what I think is important, is trying to maintain networks and continue to build connections with folks.
So if money were no object, what's one project that you would love to pursue in particular?
Oh, so I think I would love to work on a big connectivity project across the supply chain, the small-scale fishery supply chain. So from pre-harvest to export, I really want to incorporate how people move along the value chain. But also, I think our ideas of gender in fisheries has been pretty one-sided. So I would love to work with some gender experts in trying to understand the role of gender across the value chain and the supply chain. But yeah, so I think that's the project that I would do. But I don't know, if I think, not being scientific, I would love to just dive for a while. and just do some quote unquote scientific observations underwater.
Yeah,
and get to travel and do some dives. So that's, like, if someone wants to give me fund that study, I'd love to work on that. But yeah, so that's like fun project that I would like to do and see and compare different like cultural interactions with coral reefs and with fisheries. It would be another very cool project.
Yeah.
See how that changes across cultures and across traditions, I think would be amazing to do. So that may be my dream project then.
Yeah, that sounds pretty fantastic too. So yeah. you are a diver?
Try to do it as much as possible. And so try to do it in only tropical waters. I will not be doing that in Oregon. I'm not, yeah, it just does not sound appealing to me. I cannot do the cold water.
I'm totally with you.
So yeah, so I limit my diving to the tropics.
Mm-hmm. We've talked for an hour about, work and fisheries, but I always like to kind of bring it a little bit back to remembering that we're also people in the world and, mm-hmm. We can't be scientists 100% right. of the time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think, so while I was in Oregon, because Oregon is so green and there's so much to do, I've been enjoying hiking quite a bit and camping with friends quite a bit. We did a backpacking trip before I came down here. That was really fun. So I try to get outside because I spend so much time on the water, trying to get to the other side. And also, I've been enjoying cooking and baking, which may be brought on by the pandemic. I don't know. Probably. Because it was never a thing until the pandemic hit. Really good to just put on a show and just cook something or bake something to keep my mental health in as close a stable state as possible.
Yeah. So now the tough part of the interview is over and it's down to my final questions. I think I only have two left. The first question that we like to ask all of our guests is, mm-hmm. What is your favorite fish?
Favorite fish? Oh, interesting. So I think, is this fish to eat or just fish to look at?
however you want to answer this question.
Oh, great. So I will say to eat, I'll do a yellowtail snapper.
Yes, that's what I was going to say.
Fish that I like to look at, I think, is a queen parrotfish. It was the first fish that I saw snorkeling, and so that has always been something that I look for now. It's so majestic. And also, this may be controversial, but seeing a lionfish in the water is pretty cool to see. Even though it has negative effects, it's pretty cool to see a lionfish with all its tentacles just out being a boss, just moving along.
Yeah, it is pretty cool to see, even though you're just sad every time. You're like, no. Right. Is there a ton of them in the Belize reefs right now?
Yeah, there's quite a few. Okay. Yes, there were just so many. It was beautiful on one hand, and also scary on one hand to see mm-hmm. how many they are. Just like moving around without care in the world.
Yeah.
Like, this is my area. I was like,
I don't think they're going away. There are some places where they're really starting to decline significantly, though. So maybe they'll kind of, blend back into the background like all these other introduced things that go crazy and then eventually kind of taper off a little. So my final question, if there was one point or principle you could have drilled into everyone's head, what would it be?
Oh, wow. So that's a great question. It would be going, I think, humans are complex beings and humans are very complex. So don't assume that you know everything about fishers. Don't assume that everyone's story is one dimensional and that we all just have the same goals in mind. And I think that is very important for us as fishers scientists, as fishers managers, and just as people, that we're very complex. We have different motivations. So take the time to listen to someone's story and why they do certain things. And especially if it's a fisher, take the time to really, truly listen to their stories. Because I think once we do that, we're on our way to a much more sustainable fisheries, sustainable ocean. And this may be a very rainbows answer, but I think we're on our way to be a better species if we truly listen to people and listen to their motivations.
Well, Eric, thank you so much for coming on the podcast and sharing your story and your work with us. If folks want to get in touch with you online, where can they find you?
I am on Twitter at EricWadeBZ, and I just developed my website. The website is thebelizeanscientist.weebly.com, and you can send me an email, eric.wade@oregonstate.edu. And yeah, I'm happy to chat more if you want to talk more. But yeah, I always love talking about Belize, fish, or fisheries.
Thank you to everyone for listening to this 104th episode of the Fisheries Podcast. If you would like to get a hold of me, you can find me on Twitter at fishvecchio. The podcast is at Fisheries Pod on Twitter and Fisheries Podcast on both Facebook and Instagram. Or send us an old-fashioned email, feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. I hope that you enjoyed this episode. You can download past, present, and future episodes on your favorite listening app or stream it from Spotify or thefisheriespodcast.com. And don't forget to head on over to our Patreon page or Teespring store to support the show if you feel inclined. I'm Julie Vecchio. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Fisheries Podcast. And remember, people are complex. Listen to their stories.
I think it's Domino's done widely. Do people know what Domino's are? Yeah. Okay, perfect.
I feel like it's kind of common or less common in different places. My husband's from Houston and he loves Domino's. And we added the kids' t-shirts because my four-year-old really wanted a t-shirt. And I was like, there isn't any your size. Let's add them. Whew, that is a lot.